You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome to the Break a Bat podcast, where baseball meets Broadway. An attempt to show that my two favorite mediums don't have to live in such separate worlds and maybe even break some stigmas. We're happy to have you with us. Now let's play ball. Hello and welcome to Break a Bat. I'm your host, Al Malafronte, coming at you from the Broadway Podcast Network studios with a real power hitter alongside me today. From the stages of Broadway to the big screen to the recording studio, my guest today has a career that spans nearly 40 years. Whether it's Baby, Cats, Miss Saigon, this Tony and Drama Desk nominee has one of the most iconic voices in the history of show business. You may even know a little Oscar-nominated song that she performed for the animated classic Anastasia, and is one of the true sluggers at 54 Below with her phenomenal concert residencies. In addition to this, I can safely say that she may be the one person in this industry whose passion for baseball and theater tops my own. Now batting, Liz Callaway. How are you, Liz?
I'm great. That was an awesome introduction.
You feel like you're back on Broadway now, right?
Theatrical? I do. It was very theatrical. Thank you.
I mean, I can't even tell you how excited I am to have you here. The 2019 baseball season just ended. I know that you might be in mourning for the Mets, but they made quite a push this summer. You know, Pete Alonso, probably your unanimous rookie of the year, another Cy Young for DeGrom. McNeil probably looks like the best lefty hitter we've seen ever for the Mets. Overall, how do we feel about the Mets going into 2020?
I feel very confident about the Mets. It was an amazing second half of the season. As a diehard Mets fan, half the time I'm depressed, half the time I'm always a cockeyed optimist when it comes to this team. So I feel really good. I'm very curious to see who our new manager is going to be, since my namesake, no relation, Mickey Callaway, was just let go. I'm happy to say, you know, I feel bad for him because I thought I just feel bad for anyone who loses their job, and I thought the players played hard for him, but I think it was a really good decision, and it was kind of cool to see my name trending on Twitter.
I was going to say, namesake aside, if you had to pick someone, Girardi, Madden, Showalter, who do you want?
I mean, I think Girardi would make people happy. Taking a risk with Carlos Beltran might be kind of interesting.
If you could pry him away from the Yankees, he's working for Brian Cashman now.
Well, we'll see what happens. There'd be some fence mending that would need to happen, but I don't know. But I do think it will be an improvement. Mickey Callaway did some very good things, but I think some of his decision-making after two seasons were not as good. First season, I get, you know, being a first-time manager. Fine. Second year. But so we'll see.
And you got to sing God Bless America at game 162 this year. Dom Smith hits a walk-off home run. I think you set a nice tone for the offseason.
Oh my God. It was such a great way to finish the season. Even, you know, we all wanted Pete Alonso. He had broken the home run record the night before. And of course I was home watching it on TV. and listening to the radio at the same time. But we were like, oh, I want to see him do one more. And then when I saw that he was taken out, and I thought, oh my God, I said to my husband, the greatest thing would be for Dom to win the game for the Mets. And he did. So it was pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was so much hype around him. Maybe if he could pick up the outfield, he might have a role on this team going forward. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, no, he's terrific.
Now, your upbringing is pretty unique that you got to split parts of your childhood in two of the country's ultimate baseball capitals, Chicago and New York. In the Windy City, you've got Wrigley Field right in your backyard. Fergie Jenkins was pitching for the Cubs, winning 20 games every year. Ron Santo and Billy Williams were socking 30 home runs every year. All three end up in the Hall of Fame. Over in Flushing, you had Tom Terrific winning Cy Young's. Bud Harrelson's playing a Gold Glove shortstop. Willie Mays even makes a cameo. Two franchises.
I saw Willie Mays play.
Did you really?
I did. Yeah.
Wow.
I did. I shouldn't have interrupted you, but you got me all excited thinking about. Everyone knows I'm a baseball fan and I'm a very loud Mets fan, and all my friends from Chicago are like, how can you be a Mets fan when you're from Chicago? And the truth is, my dad was transferred to New York in 1969. So I moved, and I lived in Huntington, Long Island. And of course, it was the year of the Mets and the Knicks and the Jets. You know, it was like a great year for New York sports. And even though we moved back to Chicago, I always stayed a Mets fan. I mean, I like the Cubs, and my dad was a diehard Cubs fan, but my passion has always been with the Mets.
Was 69 your first year watching baseball?
Yeah.
What do you remember about that?
I don't really remember very much about the game. I remember I liked Jerry Grody. He had a mustard commercial. I was really, really young. and I just remember, like, on the school bus, everyone on the bus chanting, let's go Mets, let's go Mets. And it was really cool. And that's sort of how I started following the Mets. And then when I saw Willie Mays in fifth grade, I won best student, girl student in the fifth grade. And the prize was you got to go to a Mets game. So that was my first Mets game. And I happened to see Willie Mays. That was my first one in person.
So it's so easy for us both in the baseball fan base and the Broadway fan base to be moved by a performer, and none more iconic than Willie Mays, obviously. When you look back at that run, you know, eventually you end up going back to Chicago. Was there ever any doubt in your mind that you'd be a Mets fan for the rest of your life?
Never. Absolutely not. I love sports, and I never played baseball. I played softball, like Broadway Show League, but I had never played baseball growing up. Girls kind of didn't play baseball back then much. But no, I'm a very loyal person. I always root for underdogs, and
I can't pick any two better examples than that than the Mets and
yes,
the Cubs. So
exactly.
There you go.
Exactly.
What did you do during 69 then? Because the Cubs and the Mets were going at it for the pennant race that year.
That, you know what? I had never seen a Cubs game, and my memory of being a really, really little girl was I didn't really like the Cubs games because they come on and they would preempt my mom's soap operas back then. So all I remember is it's just like the team, you know. I didn't really start watching baseball until then, when I moved to New York. And just a side note, I went to visit my dad. This was the year after the big Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa home
98,
run.
Sure.
Yeah. And I was visiting him in Chicago, and the Mets were playing, and my dad got tickets. Because my dad was living in Chicago, very close to Wrigley.
Had you been to Wrigley to that point, or this was going to be the first time you're
gone? No, I had gone.
You had gone.
I had gone to games, and the Cubs destroyed the Mets, but I caught a foul ball. We didn't have great seats because you couldn't get a Cubs. It was like the toughest ticket in town. And my dad's like, I'm so sorry that, you know, we were sitting above, I think in the second deck above home plate, and Gary Gaetti hit it.
Oh, sure.
And I always bring my mitt. And I got, and I'll tell you, it's the best applause I've ever gotten.
Miss Saigon, you know, yeah, secondary blah, blah, to blah. That.
And of course, I'm yelling for, I'm cheering much to my dad's chagrin. I'm cheering for the Mets. And so like Cubs fans would come up to me and like, you don't want that ball, do you? Because it was, you know, hit by Gary Gaetti. And like, oh, yes, I do. So I have it in a Lucite cube.
Oh,
home.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. It's one of my prized possessions.
That's pretty amazing. And you know, it's cool enough that your dad accepted your Mets fanaticism. You must have had a pretty interesting child growing up because your father worked in the media.
Right.
Your mother had a musical background. And you've talked a lot about how both you and your sister were so involved in the arts. Take me through the Callaway household growing up. What was that like?
A lot of music. A lot of a variety of music, jazz and Broadway and pop. Our parents used to give us money once a week to buy record albums, so they really instilled a love of music with us. However, I was really shy, and I didn't like to sing in front of people, and so the only time I would sing is if everyone left the house, and I'd sing in the shower, I'd sing in my bedroom with my hairbrush, you know, with my microphone. And I actually thought that I might want to do something, I don't know, be a sports journalist or do something, anything but music, because that's what my mom did and that's what my sister did. And I was super shy. So I didn't start doing theater until I was in high school. And then I just fell in love with it and became obsessed with it. And that was the end of the story.
Was there a key moment that gave you your confidence to pursue it further?
I don't know if it gave me confidence. Growing up, I was somewhat of a loner, and my parents got divorced when I was a sophomore in high school, and I was doing the chorus of a musical, and this girl, a kind of really popular girl in my high school, said, "Hey, I heard about your parents. Are you okay? You want to hang out with my friends and me this weekend?" She was like, really, really nice, and I'm like, sure. And so I suddenly had this group of friends, and I went, oh, if I do theater, I can have this kind of, you know, family feeling and good friendships. So I went, I better get over my incredible fear of singing in front of people. And I did, for the most part.
You know, one thing that you've talked about before is obviously, you know, your sister was very involved in singing and it was a passion of hers. If I recall, a real common bond that you had was the love of the Tapestry album
from
Carole King.
Yes, we were very, very different and we had very different tastes in music. But Tapestry, that was, you know, we were living in Riverdale then, and Tapestry was the album for us. It still is. We sing You've Got a Friend together as an encore to some of the shows we do. And she's actually coming in tonight, actually, to stay with me. And that definitely brought us closer together. We moved to New York together. I was 18. She was 21. We celebrated by going to a Mets game.
Wow.
Yeah,
I can't think of a better celebration.
Oh, they were awful. They were so horrible.
Oh, that was like, was that Joe Torre years when he was managing?
Yeah, and it was like Dave Kingman and, oh my God, they were just awful, but it didn't matter. In fact, I think it was a Mets-Cubs game was our first game. And we lived in this little cheap residential hotel and I got a radio and I remember listening. I think it was the World Series that year. Was Pittsburgh and Baltimore?
That's right. Ken Singleton, Willie Starr, Joel. Yeah. That was a great World Series.
We are family.
That's right.
That was that.
You sing that one in the show,
Sue? No, but I should. Just have to put a little musical thing in here while we're talking baseball. I actually started making a list this year of like every profound moment in my life involving the New York Mets. And it was this enormous timeline of my whole life interspersed with my career and all these wild things have happened. Which is why I think it's so cool that you have this podcast. It's really neat.
Well, thank you.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And, you know, one thing I wanted to touch on, and I just find it very interesting. Part of the reason why I started this was, you know, growing up when I was a kid, music was also a really key part of my life, of course. And so was sports. My father was a huge sports fan. We come from an eccentric Italian family, though. So he also had a great appreciation of the arts. And it was always interesting to me how it seemed like sports and theater had to live in such separate worlds, or sports and music. Like, you couldn't necessarily, at least where I went to high school and middle school.
Where did you go?
I grew up in Long Island in Manhattan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was always super interesting to me. And that was a tough time, being the one guy in school who, you know, would, you know, go to play rehearsal and, you know, in the fall, and then play baseball in the spring. And, you know, I wanted to bring up Tapestry specifically because I think it's so interesting to me, much like you, as, you know, you talk about a profound album. I think Tapestry has such an uplifting effect on people, anyone who listens to it. Unfortunately, I didn't discover it till my 20s, but for me, with Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, it was really mature content, much like Tapestry is. And I think at a young age, you know, you talk about coming into your own and while you're going through a tough time and whatnot. You know, albums and music like that, they not only shape you as a performer, because you started to gain confidence as a performer right around the time the album came out. How do you think that, you know, music like that helps shape a person?
I think we all have different soundtracks to our lives. And I think sometimes you don't realize it until years later. And in a way, I don't think I necessarily realized it until I started singing some of the songs that I grew up listening to, because it's like putting on a jacket. You can admire it. And I didn't understand the lyrics, most of the lyrics to Tapestry.
Sure.
And I just know I loved it. And I loved the cover of the, you know, it was a great album cover. And Carole King is, you know, she's with her cat. And it's just like, she was just, there was something about her that I found so accessible. And, but I think if you talk to everyone has some songs or some records or albums or Spotify playlists that speak to them. And, you know, you need music in your life, whether you're a performer or not. Everyone, I don't know, music is so important. I don't think I realized it. And that's what I feel lucky about when I do concerts, is that I can sing. I love singing songs from the 60s and Broadway songs, but I really like 60s pop. And it's so interesting to sing a song and then to see the audience is enjoying your performance, but then they're remembering, oh, I used to listen to that, or my mom used to iron to that song, or, you know, and it's, I don't know. I think music just will play a very important part kind of throughout everyone's lives.
And I find it interesting, you know, just to touch back on, you know, right around when you and your sister came to New York, it was right out of high school. So you must have performed a lot in high school and realized, you know, once I'm done with high school, I want to go to New York City, make it as a performer.
That isn't sort of what happened. I went to college and went to college too.
Oh, okay. So you went to college here in the city?
No, I went to college at Cincinnati. The Conservatory of Music at University of Cincinnati.
Very prestigious
Amazing.
Institution.
Yeah, they have a great musical theater program, and went to University of Illinois. And I was there a quarter. And while I was there, I got an offer to join an equity musical theater company that was starting up in San Jose, California. And I was 17 at the time. And I just went, I want to take this opportunity. I moved to California, fell through. The job right fell away. Through. It's like, oh, okay. Now what am I going to do?
I just packed up all my books for
That's
the semester.
Right. Yeah, no, I was West done. Coast. I quit college and I worked at an amusement park in Santa Clara, Great America. And my sister came out to, I think we did some heavy duty drinking that weekend and she was going to leave college after 2 years. She said, I'm going to move to New York. I'm like, I'll move with you. I always thought I'd end up in New York, but I didn't. I never thought I would leave college and move to New York when I was 18. That was not in my plan at all.
So once you got here, what's going through an 18-year-old Liz Calloway's head?
I knew I had potential, but I knew I was really raw and I needed a lot of work. So I took classes. I auditioned for everything I could. I got a job as a singing waitress.
Wow.
And I did a club act at the Duplex and, you know, and someone saw me in the Duplex and I had auditioned for Mary Lou, We Roll Along. I went to the open call and got typed out, even though I stapled my birth certificate to my resume. but they didn't see me because there was like so many people. And then this composer, Brian Lasser, went to this club act I did at the Duplex and then told an agent he knew and said, hey, I just heard this young 19-year-old and you should submit her for the new Sondheim show because she's really good. And so as a favor to him, they did. And so I actually got an audition where I could sing 32 bars of a song. And 5 auditions later, I was cast in my first Broadway show.
Were you ever intimidated by the audition process, you know, when you had first moved here? Because, I mean, that's a lot to take on, you know, because, you know, dealing with rejection potentially for the first time and, you know, putting together an act that you feel confident in, you know, going in front of a casting director. What's that like at such a young age?
Well, honestly, it doesn't get much easier still, you know. It's in some ways, I think when you're really young, you're totally fearless. You have nothing to lose. At least that's how I felt. I had one go-to song. I used Be a Lion from The Wiz.
Wow.
I used it for everything, whether it was appropriate or not. I teach master classes in colleges from time to time. And I in like auditioning. And I was like, you guys, you have to find a song that means something to you, that you feel really represents who you are, and that you can sing it when you have a cold, and you can, you know, that just, and Be a Lion was my song, which helped. So, I mean, auditioning was never easy, but I also looked at it as it's good to get experience. So I'll audition for everything I can instead of putting so much importance on each audition. Again, I didn't move to New York to be a star. I never thought about wanting to be a star or anything. My goal was, when I moved to New York, was to get in the chorus of an off-Broadway show within 3 years. I thought that was a very sensible goal. Of course, I didn't realize there were no choruses.
On off-Broadway shows.
Off-Broadway shows. But so, you know, but I ended up doing much better and much faster than I thought. But then I'd get a Broadway show. Everyone like, oh my God, you're set now. And then it would close and I'd go back to being a waitress and definitely had my ups and downs. Watched baseball throughout. I videoed every Mets game. And back then, back in the day, there was something called sports phone. And if you were not, you've not heard of sports phone?
I haven't.
Oh,
tell
my
me
God.
More.
Oh, it was this 1-800 number you had to, I forget if it was 50 cents or what you had to put in. It was a toll call and they would do the scores. So if I was out and I couldn't wait to get home to find out, you know, who had won, I'd call sports phone.
Wow,
yeah.
That's something else.
Now it's like I've got my MLB app and I everywhere I go.
Oh, yeah, it's unavoidable.
It's amazing now.
Have you ever seen the movie Fever Pitch, by the way?
I have not.
It's an excellent one. You know what? I'm just going to scratch that whole thing because I don't want to ruin anything about it for you.
But I need to watch it?
You need to watch it.
Okay.
There's something very similar to what you just described in that movie with Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore. It's about the Red Sox.
Yes. By the way, I just want everyone to know, Al is wearing a Yankee shirt T-shirt, and I am wearing a Mets T-shirt.
I mean, she had to do this. The first game of the division series when we're recording this, as the Yankees play tonight. Yeah. But you know what? All things considered, I respect it. I respect it a lot. And we're a show about Broadway and baseball, not about Broadway and the Yankees. So just the fact that you're such a big fan.
Which is
fan
why I'm here.
Merrily We Roll Along closes after just a few weeks. And, you go back to waitressing. But then you kind of have that breakthrough moment. You get cast in Baby, and it really sets the tone for the rest of your career and makes Liz Callaway a household name. What do you remember about that time? It must have been so exciting.
It was an amazing time. Baby was such a gift. And I didn't have a normal audition process for Baby while I was doing Merrily. And by the way, I was hired originally as a swing for Merrily. And I heard about my agent that had submitted me, who's still my agent to this day,
wow,
by the way.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
That's right. And they said, they want to see you for a leading role at a show, for a show at the Public Theater called Gallery, written by Ed Kleban, who wrote the lyrics to A Chorus Line, and was going to be directed by Richard Maltby Jr. And I remember going to the audition and Richard Maltby saying to me afterwards, "You are just perfect for a show I'm writing about a pregnant college student." And I was just kind of went, "Oh, that's nice." And long story short, David Shire, the composer, came to see me do something because Richard told him. And I said to David, "I know you guys are writing the show. If you ever need someone to sing your songs, I'd love to help you." I was totally naive and just trying to be helpful. And they're like, "Well, that's really nice of you." And next week, Richard calls me and says, "Hey, you want to come over and learn a couple songs?" So I learned a few songs from Baby. Every week, I'd come back, work on a couple more. And then one day, the producer shows up, and they introduced me. I said, "Is this an audition?" And I said, "Well, you've kind of been auditioning all along." And I had no idea. And they gave me the part.
Just so young and naive and not even realizing
I was trying to be helpful. And so we did a workshop of it and a million backers auditions. And it was an amazing time. My first big role on Broadway. It was an incredible part, a great score. And, I think because of SiriusXM, who plays Story Goes On all the time, there are people all around the country, even if they didn't see Baby, they know about Baby and they know about that song, and that's how they know me, which is really, really cool. During Baby, I was, it was my first anthem for the Mets on Memorial Day.
What year?
It always goes back to the Mets.
It does. It's that timeline in your life with baseball relatable.
It was Memorial Day 1984.
Okay, so that's Doc Gooden's rookie year.
Yes. And I remember, and I found in my basement a video cassette, and I haven't been able to look at it, but I remember I videotaped it. And Tim McCarver was he did the play-by-play for TV. And I remember watching it, and he quoted Sondheim. And I can't remember what it was that he quoted, but I remember thinking, "Oh my God, this is so cool that he quoted Sondheim on my first anthem."
That's incredible.
Yeah. And by the way, my first Broadway show I ever saw while I was living in New York as a kid was Company. So
I'm Not Getting Married Today. That's a great show.
Stephen
sure.
Sondheim, director of Hal Prince, Alvin Theater, and Merrily, same thing. So getting Merrily was incredibly cool since Company was my first Broadway show.
It kind of comes full circle like that. Now, I just want to touch on, you singing the anthem, and you've done that quite a bit over the years at both Shea and Citi Field. How did that first happen? Now you establish yourself as a big Broadway performer. Does everyone in the industry know, hey, Liz Callaway is a huge Mets fan and, the organization gets wind of it? How does that happen?
Well, when I did my famous club act when I was 18, the kind of started it all, I remember I wrote a parody of You Made Me Love You And it was about, it started off with, "You made me love you." And then it went into, "Let me sing at the ball game. Let me sing at Shea." And it was this big song that I did a parody of about how much I wanted to sing the anthem. And then I'm not sure, but I think it must have been someone through Baby got me connected. But I did everything I could to have it be known. But that was like one of my life, that was one of my life goals. The New York Times on Friday used to do this weekend section, and Enid Nemi was the reporter, and they would do, I have Hirschfeld from that time of Baby, and she interviewed me, and I told her my three life dreams were, I wanted, for some reason, I wanted to sing the anthem for the Mets. I wanted to make page 6 of the Post for something that wasn't true, and to be, I don't know why.
That was an aspiration.
That was an aspiration, because I thought it'd be better for it to be something that wasn't true, and to be on Live at 5, because back then they used to have Broadway people come on, and I just thought that was cool. So like, I think in the same week, all my dreams were fulfilled, which, you know, I was like, okay, now what am I going to do? I need new goals, but singing the anthem for a team that I loved was, you know, I went to so many games, and, you know, it was, you know, back then I used to sing a lot of anthems. I sang in the 86 playoffs.
Interesting. Yeah. I wanted to touch on 86 specifically, because you're still riding the high of Baby at mm-hmm. that point. What a time to be a New Yorker, because I think you can relate to it so well, you know, being, you know, where you were at your life in 1986. You know, for me as a kid, when the Yankees had the Joe Torre dynasty, I was 9-10 years old. I was, you know, kid on Long Island. I wasn't living in Manhattan, you know, early 20s, experiencing any career success. But as you get older, I noticed it even recently, you know, to an extent with the 09 Yankees, but the 2015 Mets, the way a great baseball team can capture the heart of a city. Do you think that you're the exception in Broadway where, you know, you talk about 1986 Mets, you've got Doc and Darryl, Keith Hernandez, Gary Carter, Ron Darling, the list goes on and on. Does the rest of the theater community get into something even as big as that?
I think to a certain point, there's definitely a core of Mets fans. There's a lot more Yankees fans. And it's always been hard to be a Mets fan, just because a majority of the Yankees fans I know would really rub it in when the Mets were not doing well. There were some Yankee fans who kind of came over to the Mets side in 86, which I didn't necessarily appreciate, because I think you should be loyal to your team. There was a time, the only time I've actually really kind of liked, it's not that I don't like the Yankees, but when the Yankees suddenly had, anytime a Met player would then play for the Yankees, I'd always still root for them. You know, once
David
Met,
Cone,
yeah.
Daryl Strawberry, Dwight
yeah.
Gooden, sure.
Yeah, and so I, you know, but I've always stayed loyal to that. There are more like stagehands, you know, when you're doing a show and you want to watch baseball, the stagehands, of course, will always have, you know, the TV on, and that's where you'd hang out. Most of them are Yankee fans, but there's a nice core of us Mets fans. Judy Kuhn is a big Mets fan, by the
way.
Oh,
interesting. Yeah. Okay, I didn't know that. We might have to talk to her.
Yeah.
Now, I've always found that very interesting. So for me, for example, right now, Yankee playoffs are starting tonight, 8 o'clock show at the Winter Garden Theater. You know, you'll find time in those scenes when you're not on stage to, you know, go off and catch the Mets in like a big playoff game. All your attention is focused to that. Does it distract you from what you have to do on stage at all?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
Okay.
No. When
you're such
I did
professional.
No.
Sure.
When I did Cats, for instance, I had so much free time, because Grisabella has 14 minutes of stage time. Also, Miss Saigon, I had a lot of time where I wasn't on stage, so it was easier to follow a game. The only show I've ever done, this was about maybe 4 years ago, I did Sunset Boulevard in Pittsburgh. And the role was so intense and so unlike me that I had to stay I had to stay in character at all times and at intermission. And I wasn't friendly to people in the, you know, because I had to become this character. And it was the only show I've ever done that, like, at intermission, I wouldn't check a score.
You went method.
Yeah. That's true. When it was over, as soon as the show was over, then I check my score.
Sure.
But that was the one, it was just too intense of a role to, that I couldn't turn it off and just look at the score.
What was Shay like in 86 during that playoffs?
Oh, it was incredible. Well, actually, I only got to go to the one game.
Because you had to perform the other nights.
I was doing a show off Broadway called Brownstone for the Roundabout. But I sang at the second home game against the Astros. We lost.
Was Mike Scott pitching that game?
Wait, who?
Mike Scott.
Was he? You know, I don't remember.
I know he was like the big villain of the Mets that postseason.
I don't remember. Glenn Close sang the anthem the first night.
Another big Mets fan.
Yeah, she's a huge Mets fan.
And another Sunset Boulevard
alum.
That's
right. That's right. So she sang the first night and we won. We lost the game I sang at. And I, over the years, my winning percentage is pretty tremendous. I don't know how many times I've sung the anthem, but they very rarely lose.
Do you calculate it?
I haven't totally, but I should. Yeah. But I think I maybe in 30 years, maybe you've lost 4 games.
And out of how many times have you done it?
Probably 30-ish. And some years I did more than once.
Oh, so you do it. Oh, so when you said the 30 years, okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Now. That's pretty amazing because their record's probably right around 500 and they're playing 800 ball when you're singing the anthem.
Yeah, they are. They, you know, and the Mets people are great. They always have been so good to me. When my son was born, they sent me a box of a Mets bib, a Mets, you know. Bud Harrelson was the coach, and he signed a ball for my son. Dear Nicholas, always do your best. And they've, you know. But I was so upset that I couldn't go to any other games. And after the night of the game 6 of the World Series, I was at a restaurant downtown, and of course there was a TV on, and everyone was glued to it. So I got to see the Bill Buckner moment, and that, which, by the way, as a former Cub, I felt bad for him, but
sure,
that was, you know, and he passed away recently, and that was he was such a good player, and it was such a shame that you know, was sort of
his legacy.
But then, for game 7 of the World
Series.
Got
rained out first.
Got rained out and I could go to that, but it was rained out.
Oh, so you were all set to go to game 7.
I was all set to finally go to game 7. And the next day, though, I had to fly to Chicago. My husband and I had done Baby in Chicago, and we were nominated for Jeff Awards. We had the tickets. We had to go to the ceremony, and I was like, oh, I don't want to go, but we went. And we both lost. And I'm like sitting in this bar watching the game. It's like, I could have been there. Every time the Mets have been in the World Series, I have been out of town. I was recording my 60s album in Los Angeles in the Subway Series. I was in Australia the last World Series. That's when I knew we were going to go to the World Series because I went, oh, I'm going to be in Australia. The Mets are going to the World Series.
And they beat your Cubs in the NLCS and then, yeah it happened. Cubs. But.
No. And I will say that I did not take pleasure in how badly the Mets beat the Cubs. I felt bad.
It was a sweep.
Yeah.
Best of seven.
And I felt bad for, you know, my Chicago friends about that. And then the Cubs, you know, this year just fell apart at the end. And so I felt, you know, sorry for them.
Yeah. And Joe Maddon's out. But hey, he could be coming to Flushing soon.
Yeah, I don't think so, but you never know.
So you know what? The Mets win the World Series in 86. Fast forward a couple years. Now, I want to make another baseball parallel to you, but I'm going to use my New York Yankees as an example of that.
Go ahead.
All right. I want to bring this up to you, and you can tell me whether or not you agree with it. There's a couple of roles on Broadway that are just prime real estate. And the 1990s, I think you embody that more so than anyone, whether that be originating a role or stepping into one that's pretty iconic. Think of it like center field for the Yankees, DiMaggio, Mantle, Bernie, Johnny Damon. Pretty rich legacy. Let's start with Miss Saigon. You originate the role of Ellen, one of the biggest smash hits in the history of Broadway. At this point, you're in a different chapter in your life. What's that feel like when you're creating a role like that? That still to this day, you can look back on it, you know, almost 30 years later and look at it so fondly.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I felt incredibly lucky to get to play Ellen on Broadway, but it wasn't the same feeling of originating a role like Baby was, Lizzie and Baby. Because they had done it in London first, it was, even though they changed my song somewhat, I didn't necessarily feel like, oh, this is my part. This is, you know, Lizzie felt very much in Baby, felt like that to me. It was still an honor. It was the first time I was in a show that was a hit. It was a hit before, and it was a hit before it opened. And so that was nice, you know, after being in a lot of shows that, you know, didn't run that long. Wasn't necessarily my favorite show I've ever done, but I was very happy to do it. I actually gave birth during rehearsals to my son. They hired me pregnant, and I started rehearsals 8 months pregnant. Had him 2-week maternity leave, and then my first day back at work was the first day in the theater.
Wow, so you made it back for opening night.
I did.
That's miraculous.
It was what would the baseball, it was like Willis Reed.
A basketball reference, okay.
What would be a good baseball?
Kirk Gibson coming up
with
a hobbling leg, right?
Yes. That's what it would be. Yes, and having to climb a ladder after having a C-section was a very, very interesting experience. Yeah, I know. There's shock. There's shocked looks in the room.
Alan is shocked as I am right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. And to be perfectly honest, I don't remember that much about the experience. I was so sleep deprived. I never thought they would hire me. I just went to the audition. I said to my agent, don't tell them I'm pregnant. I just let me audition for future reference if they ever need a replacement. So there you go. Yeah. And it was, but I'm very happy I did it. And it was a really interesting experience to be in a show that you knew was going to run. That was nice. When I did Baby, we had our closing notice up every week and then they'd take it down. If I'd known we were going to run 8 months, I would have enjoyed it more. But I thought every week, this is the end. And then I did Cats, which was the first time I ever replaced someone. And I love doing Cats. That was a great, great gig.
And you did it for a long time, too.
I did it on and off for 5 years. They were tremendous to me. They'd let me go, and I did a lot of other things during that time. I did a lot of my animated movies, and they'd give me a week off to go to Los Angeles and do Anastasia, or they'd give me time off to do Sibling Revelry with my sister. And so they were very generous, and but that was another thing. Somebody says to me, so why, how could you stay? Let me try that again. People often ask me, how could you do something for 5 years, the same part? And I say, well, I have a very nice house. No, but I'm joking because I loved doing Cats. And there are probably other shows I probably wouldn't be able to do for 5 years. But I did get a nice house. I could get a mortgage because, you know, when you're in the theater, there's so little job security. Now there's a lot more super long-running shows. But this was back in, this is like the early 90s. And, you know, it was kind of a different world. And so, but if you want to apply for a mortgage and you're in Cats, okay, you're a solid citizen.
Sure.
And you're going to have a job for a long time. So.
That's amazing. You mentioned your work in animated films. Obviously, Anastasia kind of being the cream of the crop. You sing one of the most iconic songs, not just in the history of animated films, but film in general. What was it like going through that? Did you realize that it was something that was so big at the time?
I realized that I had an incredible song to sing. We had just recorded Once Upon a December, which is another beautiful song from the movie. And Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, the writers, they said, hey, you want to hear your new song? Because I had done a bunch of different demos and they had tried different songs for this one part. And they played it for me. I was like, oh, wow, that's it. That's the song. I didn't realize until when I started doing concerts and touring the country and even, you know, going to China and singing, how many people knew that song, how important it was to them, and what an impact that movie had on people's lives. And, you know, they just had a 2-year run of Anastasia, the musical on Broadway, and that brought all this new awareness to the movie. And it was such a gift. It was like, it's the gift that keeps on giving. And last year, I think it was last year, it was kind of a crazy year for me because it was like, this is your life. There was the Merrily We Roll Along documentary that Lonnie Price did.
That's right.
There was the revival of Cats, the revival of Miss Saigon, Anastasia on Broadway. It was just, you know, Sunset Boulevard again, and all these things. I was like, oh my God, this is so strange to have these important parts of my career being revived. I went, I'm getting old.
But you're touching a new generation. That's got to be so surreal for you.
Yeah, it's surreal and it's awesome. And that's really important to me. I did I produced and recorded a duet of Journey to the Past with Christy Altomare.
Oh, that must have been amazing. I've heard it actually. Yeah, yeah,
it was amazing that we got to sing together and and she was just so great. And it was so fun to go into the studio and to have this record of these two Anastasia singing together. And just, it made so many people happy. And I really want my music, I love recording, and I really want my music to be relevant for all generations, you know? And I think that's something I'm really fortunate in, that the people who listen to my music are really all ages. That's important to me.
You still crush it on stage doing these concerts, a phenomenal solo career. Actually, your holiday album, Merry and Bright, is a favorite among our families.
Oh, nice.
You and your sister are actually helping kick off the holiday season this year at 54 Below. Why don't you tell the folks at home about what you have going on late November?
The week of Thanksgiving, my sister and I are doing our show, Broadway the Callaway, and it's a really fun show of our personal Broadway favorites. We have a lot of fun in together in the show. It's very funny. And Anne recently moved to Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, wow. So that's a ways away.
It is a ways away. And she used to live 5 minutes from me. And so I said to her, okay, we have to spend one holiday together. So what if we could get do a show together? And so I talked to the folks at 54 Below and they said, we'd love you to come the week of Thanksgiving. So it's a very fun show and it's going to be fun on and off stage.
Excellent. I can't wait to see. I mean, I'm probably going to be there at this point.
I hope so.
I'll leave the Yankee hat at home just like, you know, so I don't distract you while you're on stage
and
whatnot.
You just do that now.
What are the dates?
The dates are November 26th through November 30th, I believe.
Okay. We could double check that for sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Can I tell you one more little baseball thing?
I'd love to hear another baseball thing.
So I was doing a concert a couple of years ago in New Orleans, and I was going
Fun
to be doing...
City.
Yeah, amazing city. And I was having dinner with the producer, and the show was the next day, and I was checking the Mets score at the dinner table, but I didn't want them to notice. They're like, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm checking the Mets score. I'm busted. And they said, well, you know, Ron Swoboda lives in New Orleans. And I'm like, you're kidding. I said, can we invite him to my show?
The 69 Mets.
Yeah.
It's all coming full circle now. Yeah.
If you get my Beat Goes On, Liz Calloway Sings the 60s album, if you read my liner notes, I talk about how 69 was such an important year of my life, including the Mets winning the World Series. So they said, oh, we'll try to get in touch with them. The next day, I'm getting ready to go to the theater, and I have this call, and I don't recognize the area code. Hello? Liz, this is Ron Swoboda.
And you probably dropped the phone at that
point.
Because that's
like,
what I would do.
Oh my God. And he was in North Carolina, and he wasn't able to come to the show, but he was really nice. And he sent me an autographed picture of his great catch.
Wow.
And I sent him my 60s album. And we have stayed in touch. He texts me when they hired Mickey Callaway originally. He wrote to me, you know. So we're texting buddies, and I was supposed to go to Mets game with him in the end of August. He was going to be in town. We were finally going to meet, and then he had to have heart surgery, and so he couldn't come. But I just got I'm going to be doing a concert in January with Seth Rudetsky, a benefit concert in New Orleans. And so I wrote to him, and he and his wife are going to come.
They're going to come.
So
all
I'm
right.
finally going to meet Ron Swoboda. So I'm very psyched.
It's coming full circle. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, Liz, before we wrap our time together, you know, I want to acknowledge you've accomplished some pretty incredible things in your career on stage, on TV, and movies. But now it's about to get tough.
Oh, God.
I thought it would be fun to play a little game that we call Fastball Derby. I want you to think of it like this. It's the ninth inning. Aroldis Chapman is on the mound throwing 105. I ask you a question. You say the first thing that comes to your mind. How does that sound?
It sounds good. I'd rather face Edwin Diaz, and I'd know I'd hit a homer. But that's okay.
Touche. Bring in Familia. Then you'll hit like three home runs tonight.
Goodness. Yes.
All right.
Bring it on. So just answer.
However you'd like.
All right.
First thing that comes to your head.
Okay.
Batter up. Big or Rush, performing on a Broadway stage or a solo concert?
Broadway stage.
You're a big Carole King fan, just like I am. Favorite song on Tapestry?
Home Again.
Interesting. And not everyone picks that one.
And maybe, I just realized that would be a good baseball theme for someone who's in a slump. Sometimes I wonder if I'm ever going to make it home again.
That was perfect. I'm so glad that's your favorite because I got to hear you do that right now. Please, you know, if you want to incorporate into the set list in November, 54 Below, I'm sure the audience
that's,
would love
well,
to hear.
Actually, I think we might have a song from Beautiful in our show. So
amazing. A Mets player whose number isn't currently retired, but should be.
Ah.
I mean, we're, you know, with the Yankees, that's a very regular ceremonial thing that we do. And the Mets have actually kept it pretty special. So I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, because we just, I know they're going to start to do more.
Yeah, they got Kuzman next
year.
Yeah,
Kuzman is next. Boy, that's a tough one. I would maybe, is it, if it's not too soon for an 86?
I don't think so.
I'd say Doc Gooden.
Okay.
I don't know. Actually, that's a tough question.
Because it's so rare with the Mets.
Yeah.
I know, right?
Yeah,
that's how I thought it was an interesting one.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. Hopefully Pete Alonso will be
all right, we got
someday.
Some time before that.
Yeah.
Go-to pre-show ritual.
Go-to pre-show ritual. Well, before a concert, I can tell you, first I say to myself, why do I do this? Why aren't I a travel agent? And then I say, nothing to prove, only to share.
Okay. Greatest baseball player and greatest game you ever saw live. And you don't have to say Willie Mays because I know you caught him on the back nine. So I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah. No, and I don't remember that much about the game. Just remember that he was there. The greatest... Say the question again. The greatest...
Greatest player and game you ever saw live.
Does it have to be the same... player in that game?
No, No, okay. You could say, you know, David Wright and, you know, game six of 86. That's just an example. Or you could say A-Rod.
Well, I remember the game, something I saw in person.
Yes.
What year was it? The Todd Pratt.
99. 20th anniversary of that division series. Yes.
That was
iconic.
That was amazing.
Electric.
That was really, really electric. Best player I ever saw. It's really hard for me to pick. That's a tough question. Best player of a Mets player?
It could be anyone. Just don't say Barry Bonds.
No, I won't say Barry Bonds. Best player I ever saw. I'm going to have to, can I answer it after another question? Can you
sure.
edit it in? Yeah, I got to think about that.
I've only got two more, so
okay.
Think quick. Role and performance you're most proud of?
Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard.
And before we get to the last one, anything happened within the past 15 seconds where you thought about that? You could always let us know. We'll, you know.
Best player I ever saw was
A-Rod.
No.
Griffey.
I saw.
You saw him in Cincinnati probably a few times, right?
Yeah. Who's your closer?
Mariano Rivera or
yeah,
Chapman?
Rivera.
Okay.
Rivera was pretty, he was pretty tremendous.
And lastly, best piece of advice anyone ever gave you?
Follow your gut. Trust your instincts. Don't worry about what anyone else says. Do what you feel's right.
That served you really well, Liz. I'm so grateful there's performers like you out there who not only are so down to earth, but have the same passions and interests as I do. And it's been such an honor to talk to you today. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, Al. And good luck with the playoffs. Do I sound sincere saying that?
Not at all.
Okay. But
that little smirk on your face kind of gave you away, Liz.
No, I think Yankees have a good chance. I think they have a really good chance. Could be Yankees, Dodgers.
That'd be fun.
That would be a very good World Series.
I would like that. But yeah, we'll see what happens. And in the meantime, Liz, thank you again. That'll close out the ball game here on Break a Bat. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to Break a Bat. This is produced by the fine folks at the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit and subscribe at bpn.fm/breakabat. You can find me online at break_a_bat_podcast. And you can also find the Broadway Podcast Network on Instagram at Broadway Podcast Network. It's been so great having you here with us today, and we'll see you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.